We were talking last week, and we're going to continue through it. And Beverly, we're in the middle of this series of notes, so it's the middle of the story, but it'll make sense. We were talking about Swamiji has been listing the qualities of a guru and part of how you can tell what a true guru is, which is not exactly what we're not sort of questing after a guru at the moment exactly. But he explains a couple of pages later one of the reasons why he's listing out all these qualities, because he says twofold, there are several things. The example of how a spiritual master lives shows us what it really looks like. And then the other quality is, let me say this accurately, just give me a moment. He shows us the right attitude, but this was the point I was going to make. By attuning ourselves to Master's consciousness, specifically in terms of these attributes, then we can draw those attributes into ourself. So it isn't just a question of saying, as we've said so far, you know, the Master has intuition, he has wisdom. It's that those are the qualities that we as devotees also have to acquire. And one of the most profound ways that we can acquire whatever virtues or spiritual strengths we wish to have is not so much by the application of willpower to make ourselves into those things, but by attuning ourselves to that vibration. And so the more clearly we have been able to focus in on what the characteristics are that we are aspiring to acquire in ourselves, it helps us in a very practical, everyday sense. Because the answer to the dilemmas we face, whatever they might be, is always in the acquisition of more divine qualities. And if we can begin to see even the difficulties that we face in our life as being resolvable, if we had more of steadfastness, self-control, fearlessness, intuitive understanding, divine wisdom, then we can study those qualities in the lives of the masters by the example of their life as the stories that we've heard or autobiography of a yogi that we've read or the path or whatever it might be. And then also sort of seeing them exemplified. Swami Kriyananda said something very interesting about his first reading of Autobiography of a Yogi. Many of the reasons why he was so magnetized to Master as soon as he read it is that he said that in all circumstance, Master had a perfect attitude toward the events of his life. And I've never really read Autobiography of a Yogi with the thought of Master's perfect attitude or what he said. He had such a beautiful attitude toward everything that happened. And in fact, Swamiji, you know, analyzes a few points, like, just for example, in the chapter where he's visiting Mahatma Gandhi, as Swami points out, he and Mahatma Gandhi have a slight disagreement about something, but in his own autobiography, he gives Gandhi the last word. You know, he doesn't himself try to make it any better. And when his friend, when they're going off to run off to Vrindavan together, I mean to the Himalayas together, and they're apprehended, by their families, and he tries to get his friend to agree with him to run away again to the mountains, and he talks about how his friend was basking in the familial warmth and was so disinclined at that point to sort of run away from home again. When you think about it, it was such a generous way to say it, you know. And he made some remark about his friend being, if nothing else, he was changeable. And these are just very small things, but there would be so many other ways for a person with a less gracious attitude, with less humor, with less detachment, to express himself. But he writes always with this sort of beautiful sweetness and this understanding of other people's realities. And even himself, the way he talks about himself when he goes off to see Ram Gopal Muzumdar and he runs away from Sri Yukteswar. But then he just comes back and there he is, and his guru treated him with so much detachment. Oh, you're back. And in truth, Swami tells us that Master was gone for a year and a half. He doesn't really tell you how long he was gone in Autobiography of a Yogi. He makes it seem like a much shorter period of time. But in fact, he was gone for 18 months before he returned. And then he just gives Sri Yukteswar, he takes the trouble to give Sri Yukteswar so much respect. You know, Master acted as if hours instead of days and weeks had passed since the last time I was there. You know, he's just so gracious about everything. And he, even his own graciousness about himself, you know, he went, he tried to have this experience, it didn't work, he came back. You know, he just had what Swami calls a beautiful attitude toward everything. And when we can see these qualities, not only as they were expressed in Master's life, but can come back into understanding them as principles, that this is the way in which a person who is highly in tune with God behaves. And therefore, if I'm not behaving in that way, let me think how I can bring more of those qualities into my own life. And by affirming those attitudes or embracing those attitudes, then we actually move ourselves out of delusion and into the light. So we've talked so far about the Master has intuition, the Master has absolute wisdom. And then here, one of the qualities of a guru is that he has even-mindedness or freedom from moods. That's a very interesting quality. Master said, many of his disciples, when Master was at Mount Washington in the early years, he attracted a number of women to him who were really young girls when they came. Dayamata was 17. I think her sister Anandamata, I think is an older sister, but she wasn't much older. Umamata, I think, was 12 or 13 when she came. Miramata was 13. And Daya speaks of herself as being quite subject to moods, like an adolescent girl might be, just with the sort of, you know, sense, even with all her devotion to Master. Nonetheless, it takes a while to get some mastery over your own awareness. And Master made the comment that whenever you're in a mood, Satan has a grip on you. It's a very strange statement, because you could just think that just being in a mood is a very small and passing thing. But he criticized it, or he characterized it as being a serious transgression. And by moods, what he means is, you know, just allowing yourself to lose track of the longer rhythm. And, you know, many things that we might not think of as moods are really just moods, which is just somehow allowing present circumstances to define our state of mind instead of, as he says, being even-minded in all circumstances. Now, even-mindedness is a quality that we have to understand properly, because sometimes people think even-mindedness is to be apathetic. And you'll see people who sort of just set the bar really low and don't ever really put out much energy for anything, and they call themselves even-minded. But to be even-minded is to live at a very dynamic and a very high-level state of energy, but to be able to keep your center in the midst of that. And that's how Master once, when he was late somewhere and he was running to get there, and someone said, "Now don't be nervous." He said, "You can run nervously or you can run calmly, but not to run when you're late is to be lazy." So it wasn't a question of being apathetic or uncommitted, but it's the realization that even in the midst of great dedication, we don't ever have to let the events actually take from us our sense of peace, our sense of confidence. Recently, when I was embroiled in, you know, just some interpersonal situations that were a little bit tumultuous as things can be sometimes, you know, people's feelings get involved and things get tumultuous, and it's very easy to get sucked into it. And I found myself on more than one occasion being more intense than I wanted to be, you know, more over intense than I wanted to be, not merely focused, but a little over the top. And I just thought, you know, this is not a place I want to go. And I thought to myself, you know, civilizations are going to rise and fall. And we're just going, when it's all over, we're just still going to be here. We're going to just be focused on our spiritual path. We're going to be devotees trying to find God. And, you know, little brouhahas in the course of people's lives and little disagreements and unhappy moments and even big catastrophes, they'll just come and they'll go. And at the end of it, we'll just be devotees seeking God. When Ananda was in the midst of all the lawsuit stuff that we went through, which was really unpleasant, it went on for a long time. especially when we had our trial going up on in Redwood City, and it was supposed to last a few weeks, and it lasted about 3 months. And just every day we were just engaged in this just ridiculous, horrible, prejudicial situation with dishonest people and telling lies, and just was awful. And we actually did pretty well with it. Partly Swami just set the example, but I remember even thinking in the middle of it, you know, this is unpleasant, but then it'll be over. It's just whatever it is, we have one reality, which is that we are going to continue to seek God. And even when you think like a lot is at stake, I mean, not that we've ever really been threatened, but during that lawsuit, there was the possibility that we would be wiped out financially. It didn't really happen. It was never came close. But okay, so we're wiped out financially. And then after all the dust settles, you're still a devotee and you're still seeking God. And you're just going to go on from that point. We'll still be here. I've been using that mantra a lot recently because of the continuous predictions of Master, which Swami keeps enforcing, that the economic conditions of our world are not going to hold together indefinitely. And in the face of, you know, just so much violent energy in the world and just craziness in the world, you sort of wonder, you know, whether the peaceful little lifestyle that we have is actually going to be interrupted. And it's quite natural to feel a little agitated about that. You know, will I be able to keep my living space? Will I be able to run my car? Will my job still exist? Will I have any money? Will I be hungry? You know, just all these different questions can roll around in your mind. But I've just been thinking a lot lately, you know, whatever happens, we're just still going to be devotees seeking God. And if times get difficult or times are easy, we're just still, there's a single reality underneath that. We are devotees seeking God. And sometimes even-mindedness is just reducing everything to its irreducible minimum. And then business has to be taken care of. Swami Kriyananda tells a story of when he was building Ananda, and he was living in the Bay Area, and he was teaching 5 or 6 nights a week all the way from Santa Rosa down to the Palo Alto area. And, you know, had 300 students a week in all these different classes. And then he would spend his weekends up at Ananda Village. And he was writing the 14 Steps course, the Raja Yoga course. And, I mean, he was so busy. And he was just barely making his bills because they were building what was then the seclusion retreat. So he was paying for the land, building the buildings, and just working as hard as he could. And he got himself caught in this situation where he had an agreement with one of his creditors that he would pay at a certain time, and then the man just decided that he saw an opportunity to try to foreclose on the land, so he filed a lien against the property. And Swami needed to get several $1,000 in a matter of days. And he was with a friend, Eleanor Borotinsky was her name, and he was very intense about this because this was a problem that really had to be solved. And he was, you know, there was all of his very large consciousness was strongly focused. And she said, just relax. You know, come to my house, have a cup of tea, you'll feel better. And he just turned to her and he said, I don't care how I feel. This has to be solved. You know, now, that wasn't actually losing his equanimity. It was just recognizing that this is a time that we have to concentrate. This isn't a time when we try to lower our energy. And sometimes we have this thought in our mind, and this is where I was starting with, that the way to stay even-minded is to lower our energy. You know, that if we put out too much energy, that'll make us too nervous, so we want to pull back from putting out too much energy. A friend of mine, as she was beginning to learn to expand her aura and expand her possibilities and express more and more of her nature, would find herself also feeling a little bit uneasy in that expression. And I was saying, well, if the wheel is turning really slowly, if there's any imbalance in it, it won't show. But if you start turning that wheel faster, then whatever imbalance is in there will begin to show. But the solution to that is not to slow the wheel down. The solution to that is to learn to balance at a higher and higher level of energy. Because you see, sooner or later, literally, we have to raise our energy to infinity. In the Festival of Light every week, we have that phrase, greater can no love be than this, from a life of infinite joy and freedom in God, willingly to embrace limitation, pain, and death for the salvation of mankind. Very inspiring. Such ever has been the sacrifice of the great masters for the world. And we feel, isn't that marvelous? These masters have come and they're doing this for us and it's so noble. The next line is, this is the fourth and last stage of the soul's long journey. And we've been through the other three kind of previous in the story. First one is the state of rebellion where we just forget what God told us to do and we just live for ourselves. And we crash and burn on that one repeatedly. And then we begin to ask real questions. That begins the quest. What is going on here? And then we come to the first stage is the mission. The second is the rebellion against that mission. The third is the quest. And then here is the fourth and last stage, the redemption. Lord, we offer up the little light that is in us into thy infinite light. Grant us the grace to know thee and make us ever increasingly pure channels of thy love to all. But it's really quite startling when you actually realize what's being written there, which is that every one of us has to reach the stage of an avatar. We have to be absolutely self-giving, and we have to have all the qualities of a master. We're not going to be finished until we're there. Now, will we get there tomorrow? Probably not. Who knows? But will we get there inevitably? Yes. And therefore, there's no point at which we're going to be able to say that this is enough. So it's always going to be wherever we're standing, we have to move it that little bit farther. And we have to learn to have all of these qualities not at the safe level because we've got everything under control, but at the highest level because we've learned to flow with that kind of a reality. So even mindedness and freedom from moods is an extremely interesting one. And part of it is that we just do, you know, part of freedom from moods, Master says, is selfless service. Part of the way to get there, karma yoga is a really good way to work against moods. Because karma yoga is giving your energy out in the truest sense, selfless service. Karma yoga is selfless service, is actively using your energy in some way or another to benefit others. Not merely working for yourself. I mean, your own job, even if it's a job you get paid for, can still be acted out as selfless service. It entirely depends on what your attitude is toward what you're doing, both what you're doing and what your attitude is toward what you're doing. But part of what it is that moods are when, it's very simple, moods are when we become concerned about ourselves. You know, at one of the early spiritual truths that I learned from Swami Vivekananda when I read his book when I was 18, 19 years old. He said, don't think about yourself and you'll be happy. And it was an amazing thought to me. What else is there to think about? It had just never seriously occurred to me to be concerned about anything except my own happiness or lack of it. Just, I wasn't even a selfish person, really. I mean, I was a nice person and a reasonably generous person, but I was always calculating my own position. It in my case, it came out in the sense of I was very Gemini. I was very changeable. If I set out to do this and that looked like more fun, then I would do that. And then if this didn't turn out to be fun, then I'd do that instead. And if I didn't like this one, then I'd do this one. After I had moved to Ananda Village, I showed up at work at 4 p.m. You know, and I'd started out at 8. This was within the context of Ananda Village. I finally came in at 4 o'clock and Seva says to me, good morning, just like that, you know, was all she had to say. I said, I started out on time. But, you know, just things kept happening and each one took me here, took me there. And what would be the point of that? Oh, yes, just always thinking about where I fit in and what I wanted. And not having an impersonal sense of what was appropriate and what needed to be done. After a time, I began to discipline myself, actually very strongly, to Seva's steadiness. She was very, very steady. At a time when Ananda was just nothing but people really mostly swimming in the Yuba River, she just started showing up at the office every day at 9 o'clock. And, you know, it was just her way of just, she just started setting an example of seva, of steady service. And she'd come at 9 o'clock and she'd work until 5. She just, you know, and everyone else is running around in circles, including me. And she's just slowly and steadily kind of getting this vibration of serious commitment going. But, you know, if you ask yourself, how do I feel? Then you're going to answer. And if you don't bother to ask yourself, you're not really going to bother to answer. And that has to be understood in the right way. Self-realization presupposes a degree of psychological health. And so I'm just going to presuppose that. Because yes, you can argue with me that at a certain point a person needs to learn to be, you know, yes, and all that's true. But once you've done that, this is a different stage of it. This is, you know who you are, you can be whatever you choose to be. So now we're going to choose to be like this. And I started learning that. I started very early at Ananda Village. I ended up in the kitchen of the seclusion retreat. So it was the kitchen served all the residents there. And there were about somewhere 30, 40 residents. And nobody had kitchens of their own. We just lived in little huts. And we served 3 meals a day, 6 days a week. And I cooked almost all of them. And then on the 7th day, I went to town and bought the supplies for the next 6 days. And I was busy, let's just say that, very, very busy. And it was the first time in my life I was so engaged in something that I enjoyed so much. It's what I'd been looking for my whole life, is to do something that I would really want to do. I mean, I was 24 years old, but still, all the years I'd been waiting. I always think of, what is it, you know, little children 4 years old. I've been waiting my whole life to be at Disneyland. Yeah. Well, but I was suddenly so engaged in the energy that was flowing through me that I stopped asking myself how I felt about anything. It just didn't arise. And that was when I began to really understand how an attitude of selfless service not only distracts you from the agitation of your own mind, but in a very real way, it kind of burns out that self-concern. That's why, you know, sometimes when people have children, they become transformed. They become transformed by the necessity of selfless service, and so they don't have as much self-concern, and they also then become transformed by the experience of selfless service. And sometimes parents will remember the period of their children's, you know, young age as a most enjoyable period for various reasons. But one of them is, whether they remember it or not, is because they were able to be in a state of selfless service. And without asking the question of how do I feel, you often just feel just fine because you're not always referencing everything back to me. You know, men tend to be better at this than women, but women are more sensitive to things. Sometimes men are just suppressing. Sometimes women are way too preoccupied with just how do I feel. Doesn't matter how you feel. That's what Swami's answer. I'm not trying to feel good. This is something that needs to be done, and I need to do it. And part of just being even-minded is just that. It just needs to be done, and I'm going to do it. And having that inner capacity, that's what is real freedom. We think of real freedom as the opportunity to do whatever the ego wants to do. But having to do what the ego wants to do is pure bondage. Freedom is just being able to know what is appropriate, what God wants of you. Go forward. As Sister Gyanamata put it, even granting, she said, you make too much of feeling, even granting that the right feelings are desirable, she said, just do what you have to do regardless of how you feel. And I say that with a balancing energy, but there is a certain point where you just even-minded and cheerfully just go forward. And that's what you see in the masters. They just don't, and I've certainly seen this in Swami year after year after year. There was one moment where he was making plans to go to Europe, and he was making his travel plans, and he had an overnight in London. And he had certain friends in London, there were devotees in London. And, you know, he only had an overnight and he was going on a big trip. And he was trying to decide whether or not to tell the people that he knew in London that he was going to be in London and whether to allow them to schedule a program for him. And he was going to call like this. And he sort of put his hand on the phone, took his hand off the phone, kind of went toward it, went away from it. And I teased him. I said, you're trying to decide which would be worse, to not have that night of rest and have to give a satsang. And there was something problematic about that situation at that time. To not have a night of rest and have to enter that slightly problematic situation, or have to reincarnate to do it. He sort of laughed and said yes, and then he picked up the phone. You know, sometimes one of the things also that can help you just stay even-minded about what you have to do is you say, do I really want to see this karma again? That's been a tremendous incentive for me. It's like, it's bad enough to be doing it now. Do I really want to see this again? You know, God knows there's other things to work on. I don't want to just run this story one more time. That's really held my little nose to the little grindstone at times when everything in me wanted to get away. It's like, it's taken me all this time to get to this point. I really don't want to be here again. And then you just say, it's not so bad. Swamiji was talking recently in the last service that he gave before he left Ananda Village. Some of you may have heard it. The night before that service, he watched the movie Joan of Arc. And of course, Joan of Arc does not end happily. Joan of Arc ends with poor Joan being burned at the stake, which, you know, is just one of those, like, let me think of my worst nightmare, is being tied to a stake and set on fire. It's pretty gruesome. And the movie director, not really understanding saints, this is a movie that the one with Ingmar Bergman, Ingrid Bergman, is that her name? Yeah. Yeah, and I haven't seen it in years, but it's a pretty good movie. But the director made the most of her being burned at the stake, you know, making it as horrific as it could possibly be, and made sure that you appreciated how frightened she was and how much she was suffering. And Swamiji said, that's just not true. That wasn't true to life. Master made the very interesting statement. He said, whenever people willingly accept death, especially, but that kind of martyrdom, he said there's a grace around them. If they accept it courageously with a recollection of why they're doing it, which Joan certainly did, he said far from being frightened and in great pain like that, a grace descends over them. And instead they just feel the bliss. That's what Master stated specifically. Isn't that interesting? And but then Swami just said, but even if, you know, it was going to be very difficult. And there's the other side of it too, is Master and others have also said, once the soul sees that the body is finished, it just leaves. It doesn't sort of hang out there to the last agonizing moment. That's why a lot of times people who have death and return experiences with car crashes or things like that, they'll, just before the impact, their soul will go up from their body. Many people will tell you that they watch the impact from above, if that was the experience, because the soul sees this coming and says, I think that I might as well just go now. I don't really need to be here at the moment. Remember that story about Edgar Cayce, who could see people's auras, and an elevator door opened in front of him? And there was something so odd about it that instead of stepping in, he stepped back. The door closed, the cable broke, and the car fell, and everyone was killed. And he realized, as soon as all that happened, that no one in that car had an aura. That all of their souls had already withdrawn so far that there was no light around any of those bodies. Because they all knew that they were seconds from then, they were going to be gone, and they were already pulling back. That's actually very reassuring when you think about it. Because you realize it's not at all happening the way they show you in the movies. But then Swamiji's other side of it was talking about how, but even if, you know, we do have to face something very difficult, and he actually seriously recommended that we try to visualize the worst that we can imagine, whether it's being burned at the stake or being tortured or whatever it might be, and just try to look into it and imagine yourself going through it with a certain equanimity, without getting into a mood about it. You wouldn't think about that as being a mood, but that's really what it is. You just calm acceptance and joy. He said, because nothing really lasts that long anyway. Even if it's unpleasant, how long does it last? And, you know, I experiment with this because I have a certain number of fears. Most of us have intense fears about physical pain. which is why I think Swami is always talking to us about going to the dentist without Novocaine. It's just like you think, please, sir, give us a break. But I wrote this in my book, too. I really wondered, why does he always do that? And I realized all of us fear physical pain. And most of us, fortunately, are not subject to it. So part of it, he's challenging us, you know, to actually face into everything that we're afraid of. Because if you're afraid of something, then to that extent, the karma still binds you. Because we have to become afraid of nothing, if you really think about it. Because anything that we fear, we have somehow have the idea that it's bad for us. It'll take us away from our experience of God. You know, fear is the antithesis of actual faith in God. If we have absolute faith in God, why would we be afraid of anything? Because everything that's going to come to us is going to be a loving gift from our Divine Mother for our well-being. And it's a very, very big idea. But even-mindedness is the beginning of how you accept that. Because if we allow something to shake our even-mindedness, then to that extent we don't have faith that God is still with us and still in charge. Or we don't have courage. And how do we get these qualities? We tune into the Masters. And so, you know, and you think then about the stories that Swamiji and others have told us about Master going into the park in Chicago and being accosted by some really rough character who wanted his money, and Master finally standing up and with a loud voice just ordering the man to get out, and he goes running from the park, and Master being accosted by, you know, men with guns sent to shoot him, and Master just looks at him, why do you live that way? Gary's brother Ananta used to be in charge of the Sacramento community, and it was a fixer-upper when they bought the community. Apartments that rented pretty low and were not very uplifting, and there were some quite low characters that lived there, and when Ananda started moving in and fixing it up and raising the vibration, some people got really mad, and someone actually pulled a gun on Ananta. And as I understand it, he just sort of, you know, went like that, like, go ahead. I mean, I don't know whether he thought the man really would or just didn't care. Like, okay, you're going to pull a gun on me. There was a story about Diamata once being accosted by a man with a knife who put a knife to her neck. There's a story about Michael Hebel, who's a detective up in San Francisco, and he was doing a drug bust in some little hotel in the Tenderloin, and he was in some narrow hallway in some tenement there, and this completely drug-crazed criminal just came around the corner with a shotgun, just pointed right at his chest, like, you know, like this far away, like that. And Michael, who was a student of these teachings, just thought, this could be it, you know. And as he said, he started concentrating on his breath, thinking that this might be the last one. And he just stood there and just stared at the man and just thought of nothing but breathing. Just let every other thought go from his mind. And he just breathed. I mean, imagine, you know, everything comes to a test in a moment like that. What do I really feel? I mean, even just being able to breathe evenly, the breath responds to emotional agitation. And if even to be able to do that was an indication of this certain calm. Okay, so if I'm about to go to the astral world, I'm on my way to the astral world. And, you know, there was this, like, I don't know how long, but probably felt pretty long. And nothing was said, nothing was done. And the man then just put his gun down, and Michael was able to take it and arrest him and take him in. But even if we don't actually have these experiences, you know, just practice. Practice all the time. Practice when something shocking happens, not to react to it. You know, when you drop something, when you bash into a door, when you think you're going to be hit by a car. Just all the little things that happen, just practice as much as possible. Just be even-minded. Why react? Why scream? Why make a big deal? Why remember it for a long time afterwards? Just even-minded. These are the characteristics of the Masters. You know, even when, this is why when we talk about the eight manifestations of God, we make a distinction between peace and calmness. Peace is the absence of agitating energy. Calmness is the ability to remain deeply centered, no matter what agitating energy is going on around us. Even-mindedness is the practice of calm, because if we're only even-minded, if we can reduce everything to a state of peace, we don't really have anything yet. Okay? Moods are just another part of that, where moods are... Master said, moods are the result of past overindulgence in sense pleasures, where we were used to stimulating ourselves and then feeling satiated and then overstimulating and then feeling satiated. And so we got used to this kind of up and down energy. And even if we're not acting that out now, the tendency to go up and down gets planted in us from that experience. It's an interesting statement. And he said, you know, that you have to just learn to resist those moods. It's a karma you have to pay off. You know, we're so... actually the word that comes to mind is dumb. We're so exceedingly dumb that we imagine that there's no cause and effect. You know, we just do things that are completely against the actual right flow of our energy. And then we think that, well, there'll just never be any consequences. You know, young people squandering their youth, people just abusing their bodies in one form or another, we just think there'll be no consequences to it. Of course there are consequences. And even if we don't remember, and this is, it's just something that after a while we just have to have the courage to deal with, that if this is happening to me, if this is the karma that I'm struggling with, I just have to struggle against it courageously, because nothing will be served by running away from it. It's a very deep and helpful realization that bad enough that I'm seeing it now, I really don't want to see it again. I just don't want to face this karma another time. And even if we think we can't stand it, this is where the attunement with the guru comes from. Whatever the consciousness that we know we need, then we know that the master has it. And if we link our consciousness to his, then we'll be amazed. You really will be amazed what you can have that is so much more than yourself. This is where you begin to realize that this is all about grace. You know, that if we just put out the effort to attune ourselves, then everything else shifts. We're not changed in the way we think we're changed. We think we're changed by this systematic, I'll figure this out and I'll do it kind of energy, and we figure it out and we do it, and then another thing we have to figure out and do and figure out and do. But at a certain point, it just shifts into something else. And that also is what part of what keeps us even-minded and cheerful. You know, I'm the disciple of a great master, and when everything is over, I'll still just be a devotee seeking God. So what is there really in this whole world to get upset about? Years ago, Jyotish, who was very much of a philosophical mind, the first round of geodesic domes we built at Ananda Village that, in a certain sense, fortunately, all burned to the ground in 1976, Jyotish had one of those early ones, and you may remember that that house leaked a great deal. And when he married Devi and she moved into it, he greeted her after that house burned to the absolute ground by saying, well, you know that problem we were having with leaks? We just don't have it anymore. That was what he said to her. And that was telling her that their house was ashes and everything they owned had been burned up. But before he was married to her and he was living in that house, we used to have torrential rains up there. We were having this torrential rainstorm. And for some reason, I had to go over to his house in the evening to deliver something or speak to him. And I came in, and there was no electricity at that point. And we had these propane lights with these little cloth mantles. And they would give a little light like this. So you would read or... whatever you did, you would sit right within that light. And it was perfectly fine. I mean, you're only in one place and you do what you do. And if the rest of the house is somewhat shadowy, it didn't matter. And so Jyotish was sitting in a comfortable chair with a book under the propane lamp. The rest of the house was slightly shadowy, but light enough for me to see, because I walked in and there was the sound of many rushing waters in the house. And I looked up. And Jyotish had gotten this big funnel. I've never seen anything like it. My recollection, perhaps I've exaggerated in memories, it was like about a yard in diameter. And he had isolated that most of the water was coming in like somewhere up toward the top of the dome. So he had put this funnel up so that as the water came in, it went into the funnel. And then he had this long tube And it ran around like this, and then it went into the kitchen sink. So that just solved a problem, you know, because they were unfixable for some reason. So all the water just ran down the kitchen sink. So I'm seeing him sitting there in this rainy thing, you know, huddled over there, just reading his book very calmly with this water rushing through. And I said, Chotish, how can you stand this? I don't know why I said that. I lived even more primitively than that. I said, how can you stand this? He said, well, at this point in my life, I figured out that some things are permanent, and I mean, things that are permanent are hard to endure, but things that are temporary are easy. He said, and then the more I thought about it, I realized everything is temporary. And so what difference does it make? And that's actually, it's a very interesting way to look at it. Everything but the bliss of God is temporary. Remember that story Swami tells us about Norman, who was his really good friend at Mount Washington? And Norman was very inclined to be moody, and he would fall into these really black moods of despair. And he came into Swamiji's room once, and he sat on the edge of the bed. He was a big man with this really heavy, dramatic sigh, and he put his head in his hands like this, and he just, without words, just expressing this, you know, incredibly, you know, cosmic anguish. And Swami wanted to cheer him up. He thought this was cheerful. Norman, look, I know you're suffering now, but how long can it last? 40, 50 years at the most? Like this? And Norman looked even more horrified, as Swami said, and ran from the room. To Swamiji, that seemed like a very cheerful prospect. We're disciples of a great master. How long can this last? So if it's 40 or 50 years, what difference does it make? I mean, these are jokes, but they're not really jokes. If you really just stand back, because all we ever have is our consciousness. And if we allow anything to pollute that, we are polluted. But nothing has polluted it, really, because it can't be polluted. We have only allowed our awareness to be distracted from being even-minded and cheerful, calm, acceptance, and joy. And that's what the masters manifest. I remember with Swamiji, I've just seen it so many times. A situation happened where Swamiji really put forward this whole reality that he thought was going to happen, and in a very public, actually in a national way, he just put out this big energy, and everything that he had declared was going to be true totally fell apart. None of it happened. It wasn't his doing exactly, it was other people and so on, but it all just came to pieces. And Swamiji was just sitting in his living room, and he said, if I chose to be, I could be quite embarrassed. He said, but I think I won't be. It was just so interesting. By anybody's definition, it was an embarrassment. You know, it was a foolish, he looked like a fool. But he said, why would I choose to accept that definition of what's happened? And then he just remained just like he was. And another situation where something else that he really had counted on and thought was guided by Master didn't turn out to be true. And it was very interesting. After that happened, he became very withdrawn. And he was very, I would say he was grave. He was very grave for several weeks, very grave. You know, he just wouldn't be distracted from his gravitas at that moment. And then one day he just popped out and was perfectly fine again. And he said, I felt guided by Master to follow a certain course of action. And when that it didn't turn out at all as I expected, he said, it called into question, you know, the fundamental premise of my life, that I can be guided by Master, that when I feel his guidance, it's true. And he said, so I had to really stand back and you know, really reflect. But then he said he finally realized that even though the form of what he thought was going to happen had not come to fruition, the intended result had happened. But it had happened in a completely different way. And as soon as he perceived that, it was like instantly, oh, that's fine. You know, there's no more need for any other attitude or feeling. Let's just keep our thoughts in mind on the main principles. And that's all that really matters. I could be very embarrassed if I chose to be. But why bother? It's a very powerful way to be. All right. It's a little bit early to take a break, but since I spent so much time on that quality, why don't we just stop and then I'll... So let's just take a short, like five. I was asked a question during the break, which is a very good question, so I wanted to answer it to everyone and completely, both at service and at other times, I believe, in this class, because I've been talking about it a lot. I've been talking about the fact that if you attune your consciousness when you're trying to transcend some limiting qualities in yourself, I was talking on Sunday about when you have meannesses of the heart and you want to release them. And sometimes they're very hard to release. I was really enjoying in a perverse sort of way, observing myself dealing with karmic residue of karmic, you know, incidences from God knows how many lifetimes ago, and still just like folding my hands and wanting somebody to say they were sorry for the way they treated me. I mean, you know, just like stupid things that have happened centuries ago, but you're still just holding on to this little bit of a tantrum and you want somebody to make it right before you're going to give in, just like little kids. And that was what drove me to realize there's got to be another solution here. And I came to this thought of, in my case, I really consciously and very vividly could feel Swamiji's consciousness inside of me and stood inside his consciousness and looked out at myself and the circumstances and the conditions and other people in my life. And he has the most amazing ability. I mean, I understand it because I've seen it, and it's master's ability given to him to just love everyone and be just so impersonal about it. I've remarked on a number of occasions how people can be completely at odds with each other on factual matters or decisions, and Swami still manages to make everybody feel that he's supportive and sympathetic to their position, even though their positions can be completely opposite each other, because he's so accepting of us. Recently, a friend was talking about he was trying to gather Swami's support for a certain course of action, and Swami was not entirely willing to support that course of action, but he blessed the man, because he always blesses us, no matter what our course of action is, because when everything else is over, we're still just going to be devotees seeking God. So that kind of even-minded, open-hearted acceptance and just that calm faith that it's all going to resolve, so why get agitated about this and take sides and everything? Now, the question, though, that was asked me was, how can you know that you're really in touch with that consciousness? And the first part of it is, it's important to realize that just because we think we are, it doesn't mean that we are. So a certain amount of respect for the possibility for us to delude ourselves is really important. One of the dangers on the spiritual path that Patanjali enumerated is false visions. That we just think that we're having these divine experiences, but we're really just throwing things up from our subconscious. So that's a kind of a scary thought, because if you're having the experience, you think you're having it. But part of why Patanjali said that is so that we will not be too eager to claim, but we'll be willing to just be humble about, you know, this seems true, I think it's true. But the real answer to the question is the question as it was asked to Jesus. When Jesus was asked the question, how can you tell a false prophet from a true prophet? And it's really the same question. How can you tell a false vision from a true vision? How can I tell a false revelation, a false transformation from a true one? The answer was, by the fruits. If you have really, you know, placed yourself in the presence of the Master and really offered yourself to it, you will be changed. And even if you're not transformed forever in an instant, there will be a residue, at least, of the superconscious nature of that experience. And so you don't have to be afraid to try, and you don't have to be afraid to fail. You just keep working at it, and it will teach you. And this comes back also to even-mindedness and freedom from moods. You know, when people say, I got over it. I'm done. I'm free. You know, I had this great meditation and now I know and I'm not going to. I always think, just like be a little calmer about this. It's almost like one of the fruits that you can tell is if there's too much excitement, the chances are not great. Because all you've done is just flip over to this other, like, affirmation of liberation. Whereas when you're actually liberated from something, it's sort of like, look at that. Wow, it's just gone. And even if you are elated about it, by its very nature, it's a calming energy. So my feeling has always been, I'm not really paranoid about the things that happen. And when they really do change, you just feel different. And if you're not sure, just be not sure. Just try again, because at least we're trying in the right direction. Most of the time, false hallucinations set in because we become egoically involved. And we either get our self-worth from being able to claim this, we get our sense of confidence from being able to claim it. You know, everything about the spiritual path is in the Festival of Light. It's amazing to me how many lessons there are in that. And one part of it is, first, the little bird is being battered about by the winds. And the more he fights back, the weaker he becomes. And the wind says, you know, go with it. Don't fight against it. Just flow. And then I will be able to lift you. And so the little bird accepts that. And he finds that now he's flying higher because he's cooperating with the flow. That's what that's really about. But then hours pass and night falls. And the little bird grew afraid. And the bird says, how can I fly in this darkness? And I always think about there's sort of levels of surrender to God's will. Now I'm going to cooperate with God's will and I'm going to fly around and it's all going to be better than it was because I'm going with the flow. But then all of a sudden, I can't see anymore. I can't remain in control. I don't know where I'm going. I don't have this all under my ego's thing now. It's just dark. How can I fly in this darkness? It was fine, God, as long as I could still have this modicum of egoic mastery. But now it's dark. And the night says, surrender to me. Peace awaits you in the unknown. It's a tremendous phrase. Peace awaits you in the unknown. So a lot of times, we just don't know. We don't really know where we stand. And we're not sure whether the whispers from eternity have really been a true message. We think they are. They seem to be. They feel like they are. They seem to be bearing fruit. But we can't corrupt that by grabbing it with our ego. Because oftentimes, true superconscious intuitions are corrupted because the ego tries to hold on to them. And whereas by their very nature, they're too subtle for the ego to hold. And so it's really important that we just also surrender not only to the wind, but to the dark. And just, I think I'm doing the right thing. Feels like the right thing. We'll see, won't we? Swamiji has always been so humble about his guidance. Even though he has more right to claim it than anybody I know, in more recent years, he's been more emphatic. But for many years, he would just, and I know he had more certainty, but partly he modeled it for us. Seems like a good idea. Let's try it and see how it goes. You know, what do you think? And it would just be showing us that even when you feel that you're being guided, don't corrupt it with egoic certainty. Because it's just too easy to lose the thread. I've often told you the story of a project we were involved in once, and there were a lot of people involved, and I just had a very strong intuitive sense of what decision we ought to make and which way we ought to go. In a way that when it comes to me, it's rarely wrong, and it doesn't come to me very often, so when it comes like that, I don't doubt it, and it did. And so I declared it, and nobody wanted to hear me, so I declared it more forcefully. And they still didn't want to hear me, so I began to argue it. And finally, I had created such a mess that everybody was up in arms left and right. And nobody could think clearly about anything. And I just wrote a letter to all parties involved and said, you know, even if my intuition is true, at this point, I have just muddied the water so completely by my insistence that I completely withdraw from the discussion and just leave it to everyone else to decide. And I stood back, and they all came to the decision that I had announced at the beginning, because it really was the right decision. But I had to just let that whole, but it was a very good lesson for me, because the intuition was true, and in fact was borne out later by everyone else's conformance and then events afterwards. It was exactly right. But I had corrupted it. And so even if you have a true vision, you can also corrupt it. I mean, that's why Master calls it whispers from eternity. He doesn't call it neon billboards from the other side, you know. It's very gentle the way he offers it. Because that's how we also have to deal with it. You have to listen really carefully to what's happening. Does that make sense? It's a very, very important question. And one that you just have to play with all the way through. At least, let me say that. It's where I stand right now, I still have that same very... I mean, I'll go forward if I think something's right. I can be quite determined if I think it's right. Especially if it has that particular feeling to me. I'll just really stay with it unless I absolutely can't. But at the same time, at any moment, it could be the rug could be pulled out from under me, and you have to stay there. You have to be attached to doing God's will. And if you think this is God's will, you should be determined. But what you really have to remain attached to is doing God's will, and that means you have to always be asking, is this God's will? And never become so egoically involved that you can't hear that question. That's the story I told in my book about working on the incorporation of Anand as a California city, that Swamiji received the intuition that we should drop the project, and I did not receive that intuition at a certain point in it. And I said, why didn't God tell me? He said, were you listening? Not particularly. You know, I was so fixed on what I was doing that I had really stopped asking the question. It was very simple, and as soon as I said that, I just laughed, and Swami laughed, and we just left it at that, because I'd answered my own question. And then I got to play, and it was really quite fun. What am I really attached to? I was so involved in the project, so committed to the project, and then in a matter of a minute, it went away. It didn't culminate, we didn't have a victory, we just stopped. And so I was off the job, because the job had just ended like that. And so I had got to find out, what am I really attached to? And I was quite proud of myself, actually. That, okay, if this isn't right to do any work, we'll stop. And it really took me just, you know, a minute just to let it go. It's a fun thing to practice. I mean, all the things that we're involved in, if it really came, that we really felt, and in the case of Swamiji declaring it with that kind of energy, there was no question in my mind as to whether it was the right advice. But it's a fun thing to practice. All the things that we're committed to doing, if we, in a moment we just had to walk away from them for any reason, if it was just suddenly made impossible for us, you know, what are we really attached to? If we really knew that God wanted us to do something else, would we be able to just easily accept that? I mean, it's not an easy assignment by any means. You know, the people in our lives, the circumstances, the positions we have, money, comfort, you know. And it's not that you have to do it. I've also, when I was working for Swami Kriyananda as his secretary, I had another job, but I also worked for him in the evenings, every afternoon at 4 o'clock. Seva and I would go to his house, Seva and I in Kalyani sometimes. Every afternoon at 4, except Saturday, and Sunday. Sunday was a different schedule, but Monday through Friday, every afternoon at 4. And that really crimps your life, because we never knew when we went at 4 whether we'd be out at 4:15 or at midnight or 2 in the morning, you know, so you could never have any plans, because at least I would never have any plans, because I always wanted to be able to do whatever he wanted to have done, whatever it might be. So... and he knew that. He knew perfectly well that I had no other interest and no other commitments. And every time when I would show up again at 4, and he paid my salary. I was his employee. He would always act oh, there you are again. And it wasn't as if he thought that I would be so irresponsible to not come. That was never a question in his mind. But it was as if he erased from his consciousness any sense of expectation or obligation, especially any sense that I was obliged to him. If I decided to show up at 4 o'clock, he was just so delighted that I had showed up at 4 o'clock again and just treated me with this every single time, with this completely fresh, enthusiastic welcome. Oh, well, there you are. And even when he would ask things of me, again, I worked for him, but he would very rarely offer a direct request. He would always sort of lead into it and then give me the opportunity to volunteer. You know, like he would say, I was working all day. I was pretty busy since early this morning. I was surprised to see it's 4 o'clock and you're here already. Swamiji, did you have lunch today? Did you eat anything? Probably not. Would you like me to make you something for dinner? Oh, would you? If you're not busy. You know, it would just be like that. Or, I've been editing these pages and look how many changes I've made. Well, you'd probably like those pages retyped, wouldn't you? Oh, that would be so helpful. And it wasn't, and you see the thing, it wasn't an act. It wasn't like, oh, if I treat my employees this way, they'll be more nicer to me. It was actually in his consciousness. That's so many things about him that have been so unusual. It's not like he behaves well. He perceives it differently. Because everything is, you just let go. You don't define people by what they do for you. You don't think of them as just people who are going to do things. They're just who they are in their own nature. Isn't that interesting? I mean, these are the qualities of, that's why when I say I want to have a more generous and free attitude toward people, I try to find his consciousness. Because if I can find his consciousness, then attunement to it. And see, when you're in tune with it, and this is what I said also, the ego goes away. When you're in tune with that, you cannot simultaneously be in tune with your small-minded desires. Because one simply cancels out the other. If you're listening to one radio station, you can't be listening to one over here. Because you've moved the dial. And the incredible secret of, well, the next quality is fearlessness, which we were talking about with even-mindedness too, is that it just depends on what you're tuned into. That's such an interesting aspect of it, because all we ever have is consciousness, and consciousness is not self-generated, it's received. So the more we tune into the consciousness, the consciousness of the master, the more we receive his consciousness, and we simply don't receive the other consciousness. That's what I was saying with Swamiji. It's not like good behavior. It's not discipline. It's that he's receiving a different vibration. And receiving that different vibration, there is only one way to act. And it's really quite different than people think it is. And that's when you start saying it's all grace. It's all God flowing through us. And when God flows through you, far from having this, which is what people think, God flowing through me. Well, you know, yes, of course it was good because God flowed through me. You know, kind of energy. It's just completely the opposite. And you get so childlike in your enthusiasm. Yes, it was really good, wasn't it? Because you feel so completely uninvolved. Even though your body was present and your own creative abilities were used, and it's just, that's how Swami says, how has he accomplished so much? Well, I've never done anything. That's what he'll say. And it's not an act. He just really, literally feels like he hasn't done anything. And you can point out all the things that were done by the entity that is him, but he just didn't really feel them. And I was talking, was it yesterday or somewhere I was talking? He's begun to so disidentify with his whole life that he just has this most interesting sort of spectator relationship to it. It's like he peers out at, my, look at all those books. You know, and I was telling you, or somebody I was telling about him just asking me a question about why did we make that decision? And I explained to him, you know, what our thinking was and why we did it and when we did it. Oh, he said, yes, that was right. And it was just so charming. Because it was he who'd made the decision, and it was the right decision, but he just so disidentified with it that he hadn't actually forgotten it, he just detached from it. You see, we can practice that all the time. But both successes and failures. Just give it to God, let it go. This is brings us into our quality of fearlessness, which is really such an interesting quality, because so many things in us make us shrink, don't they? I was in the middle of the lawsuit once. I'm not really that courageous. Or at least I used to be less courageous. I think I'm more so now. But in the middle of that lawsuit, this really awful lawyer was harassing me and following me. And I finally just turned and really told him off. He was this kind of crazy guy. I just told him off like this and kind of, you know, went at him. And afterwards, I was so proud of myself. You know, and I did it just instinctively. It was just sort of an instinctive, don't you bully me like that. And there's such a tendency sometimes when people are acting in a bad way that we shrink inside ourselves. Danyon Brinkley, who wrote the book Saved by the Light, he was the man who was struck by lightning and died. And in the years since then, which is 20, 25 years now, he's dedicated himself to hospice work and all teaching people about death because he had these incredible afterlife experiences. He was one of the most fearless people I've ever seen. He came and spoke in our church. We somehow managed to get him to come and speak here. It was really, those who were present, it was a remarkable night. He just was absolutely, and he was totally unafraid of other people. And you know, normally people have a certain reticence. I don't know exactly how to describe it, but he had just had none. He was just with you, whoever you were, wherever you were. He's actually became a mentor of mine from that experience and watching him. And he talked about just being with homeless people and crazy people and how just everybody's really the same. And Swami Kriyananda, of course, is a great example of it, but Danyon was so much more over the top with this energy. It was somehow more manifested to me. And I oftentimes, and this is the same question of attunement, when I see somebody who is icky and whose ickiness makes me nervous, you know, somebody who's a little out of it, I always think about Danyon and how he just kind of just steps right into the space where they're standing. And you just tune in, like, what would I do if I were someone else? What would I do if I were master? How would I really do this? And you realize, I mean, I suppose there are people in the world who really are evil and will hurt you. And therefore, you do have to exercise some common sense. When I first moved to Ananda Village, I lived up there in the seclusion retreat, and I scarcely left. And maybe after about 6 months, I had to come down to the Bay Area for some reason. And one of the things that had happened when I was living at the seclusion retreat is that a tremendous number of psychic protections had shifted off of me. I'd only lived my whole life in environments that were not congenial to my spirit, even though I lived with my family and I lived in nice places, but nothing ever vibrated with me. So I was always in this protective energy. I was always protecting my energy from everything around me. I mean, I really literally feel like I stood on the sidelines of life until I got to Ananda. I just never wanted to be part of anything. So when I went to live at the seclusion retreat, which was especially very isolated, and we just lived in our own little universe there, I drove into Nevada City, but that was pretty light stuff. And so I just began to get into this habit of being extremely open. And I was driving down from the Bay Area, and I suddenly noticed I was out of gas. And I just pulled off the freeway without even thinking, and I pulled into some really bad part of Oakland, I think it was. And I was just, you know, just full of light. And there was this really big, tough guy there. And I was just being so like this. And he began to misread my energy, let's just put it like that, you know. And he sort of began to move toward me in a way that, and then all of a sudden it was just like, oh my God. And I sort of jumped back in my car, rolled up the window, you know, it's just like, I just didn't realize what I was doing. And now, part of that was positive, but of course it was also foolhardy. But it was such an interesting realization to just remove from your consciousness so many fears. One of the things at the seclusion retreat I learned was I was no longer afraid of the night. You know, when you live in a city, you have a certain anxiety about the night. When you live, as we did, in a very safe country place, I didn't fear the night anymore. And it just was one sign of how many levels of anxiety we carry within ourselves. And all of those bind us. And the masters, what do they have to be afraid of? Swami Kriyananda, I was asking him these questions, and he's written it in his own book, but I was asking him more exactly. When he tells those stories about when he was a child and he was beaten up by various of those boys that he was beaten up by, he has that story in The Path, and he tells it in a couple of other places. Really big boys, like the 200-and-something-pound boy just pounding on him, and he weighed 107 pounds, and telling him, he said he was going to throw him out the window. And Swami thought he really might. And the reason Swami didn't call for help, because his friend said, why didn't you call for help? Swami just said so simply, I wasn't afraid. And I asked him, well, didn't it hurt? He said, yeah, you know, it hurt. I said, were you oblivious to the pain? That was my question. I said, you have this capacity to transcend pain. Were you able to transcend the pain? No, he said it hurt. But he thought, well, you know, it hurts. But what is there to fear in that? I mean, this was how he was even as a child. These were questions I was asking him of how much did you change when you met Master, and how much did you just bring these qualities to your discipleship? But I've really thought about that a lot. He just wasn't afraid. This boy was going to, you know, just beat him up and throw him out the window. But so these are all, fearlessness is one of these qualities. It's just these things have to happen. And when SRF was really going after Swamiji, and when those lawsuits started happening, the first lawsuits were filed, the second lawsuits were filed, Swami was very intense. He was not frivolous. He was extremely serious, and he put a tremendous amount of energy, and he saw the magnitude of the threat, you know, because you can be fearless, but that doesn't mean you're stupid. You know, my energy with that man in Oakland was stupidity. It wasn't courage. It was just stupidity. And as soon as I saw that, I stepped back because I didn't have Master's magnetism. You know, to be able to convert that kind of energy into loving energy, that energy was going to convert me into itself. He was going to win, not me. But nonetheless, so when Swamiji saw, you know, that Ananda was really threatened, that his work was really threatened, he was as powerful as he could be. But one of the reasons he was so powerful is that he wasn't afraid. It was, what can they do to me? In the end, after everything blows over, I will be a devotee seeking God. And so what do I have to lose? These are marvelous meditations for us to have. I've shared with you once that I had this flash of insight once, just literally walking up the stairs in my apartment. I just was starting up the stairs, and I was conscious of an undercurrent of anxiety, which by the grace of God I have less of, but you know, I'm a little bit of a tightly wound person. I'm much less than I used to be. But I was aware of this just sort of subliminal kind of tension about various things. And I thought very strongly of Master just in that moment, and I realized that he was afraid of nothing. He had no anxiety. What could he possibly be anxious about? And just for a second, I could sort of sense that. Oh my God, what a difference. You know, and these are the practices. This is how we entertain ourselves through our lives, and we're just on a dull car ride, you know. What can I just not be afraid of? How can I practice being fearless? And in every small way, because a great deal of our spiritual progress does not come in gigantic moments. It comes from this constant sort of pushing against our limits. This constant willingness to face into whatever it is that has to be faced. Just deal with it. I have to go and talk to someone about something that's very difficult. I'll just do it. Somebody's going to come to talk to me about something I really don't want to hear. I'll just do it. I'm going to have to go to the dentist and have that awful work done. I'll just do it. Just, you know, day after day. At one time, when in that Sunday service that Swami I was referring to, he says, in movies and places like that, sometimes when you see things that are really difficult, he said, you know, just practice just accepting it as if it were real, as if it were really happening. We've walked out of a lot of movies. I've walked out of a lot of movies with Swami. We'll go into a movie and then he just won't like it. And you lean over and this is the characteristic posture. He'd have his arms folded like this. And you hear him going, like that, exhaling with a double breath. And you say, "Sir, would you like to leave?" "Yes, let's leave." And we were at some movie in Grass Valley and it was a double feature. I do not remember the names of the movies. I still try to blot it out. And they were both horrible. I mean, horrible, violent, horrible. People were being tortured, things like that, two of them. And I mean, I can't stand things like that. And I kept looking over, you know, like, we're going to go, but we sat through both of them. I mean, that only happened that one time, but I've never forgotten because it scared the bejesus out of me. And the images that movie put in my mind can still frighten me. But then afterwards, he said something like, sometimes it's good to just watch things like that and see and not be affected by them. And I was so profoundly affected. It really was very interesting. Sometimes it's good, he said, just to sit there and not be affected. So I still, to this day, like I try to visualize some of the scenes in that movie and try not to be affected. Imagine it's really happening and try not to be affected. Because if you're afraid of it, you've still got karma there. And you really don't want to see it in real life, that's for sure. But then even that fear, you see, masters are afraid of nothing. Many great saints are martyred. I don't think Jesus was quaking in his boots about being crucified. Yes. Yes, to a certain extent. Yes, you can. If you face it strongly enough with enough courage, you can resolve it to a certain extent, yes. To a certain extent, to the extent to which you really can face into it. I don't know how that really works, because Kriya also, I mean, if we're still afraid of being tortured, do we still have to face torture? I would hope that we don't. I don't know, though. I can't say for sure. I know that I'm concerned about the things that I fear, because the fact that I fear them binds me to them, and I fear them, and therefore I don't want to live through them. So I try to pray to Master to be unafraid. And I try to practice courage, even in small ways. You know, you're going to have a shot. You're going to have a cut. You're going to have a medical procedure that's scary. You're going to have a dental procedure that's scary. I can't not take Novocaine. I just don't have the nerve. But even still, you know, dental work is very unpleasant, you know. Even-minded, to be unafraid. What difference does it make? I mean, you just practice all the time, and then you have to leave the rest of it in God's hands. I don't know. I hope not. But even the hoping not is, there you have it. I've always expected, as I've told you all, to go to a concentration camp, but that's just my Jewish heritage. And it's been great, because it's made me very detached from material things, because I expect that they'll all be taken away from you in the end anyway. My friend who has all these family heirlooms, I've said this to you, I finally realized what completely bewildered me about her family heirlooms is, you mean, they don't just take it away from you at the end of your life. You know, your mind is just so set in these ways. You mean from generation to generation, you get to keep all your stuff? Don't they take it away and then just put you in the camps? Strange, isn't it? You know, all these things that are just in us, and they all have to be resolved. But you can't do it one by one. You just keep giving it to God. Everything you're afraid of, you just keep tuning into God. How can I fly in this darkness? Well, gee, if I surrender, I guess there's peace on the other side. That's why we repeat that every week. Every time I come to that one, how can I fly in this darkness? Peace awaits you in the unknown. 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 Okay, okay. I hear it. You know, just like, okay, it's all right. I don't know where I'm going. It's dark, but it's all right. I'll just go there with you. It'll be okay. From a life of infinite joy and freedom in God, willingly to embrace limitation, pain, and death for the salvation of mankind. Here then is the fourth and last stage. Ooh, really? Okay. You know, you just go over it and over it and over it. We have all the time in the world to come to it. Okay. God bless you.